Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Gallegos, here with
Jeff Rappaport.
Guys, we're still in our series on the how-tos of creative financing. And this has been a long series for us, but super, super informative. We went, you know, from the simple details of it to, you know, to how to talk to sellers about creative financing, how to talk to agents, how to write up the paperwork, how to use a down payment. And then, you know, last couple episodes was, you know, how to make multiple offers and really how to make your offers stand out from one another so that the seller has reason to take one over the other. On this episode, we're going to be talking about how to structure something around an existing mortgage. So using a wraparound mortgage, or, you know, in our state, it's called an all-inclusive trust deed. But really how to do that. And Jeff comes up against this a lot when he's structuring financing. You know, almost everyone owes something on their property. I mean, you know, not everyone, but close to it, right, Jeff? I mean, there's probably the majority of people you come across still have some kind of debt on their property.
Yeah, I think that there's some statistics that show, and, you know, who knows what's going on right now, but I think there's about 35% of all properties are free and clear. So that means that 60, 65, 70% have some kind of debt on them.
Yep. So how do we do that, Jeff? I know this is, you got to take their payment into consideration, and there's not, you know, too much more. I guess it depends on their monthly payment, but you can't offer the seller a whole lot more on top of their monthly payment, really. And still make it work unless they have really a really super low payment.
So what I want to differentiate is that all the examples that we just did through the last few episodes were on a free and clear property, where we have all of these potential strategies available to us, right? Yep. We can structure subordination, we can structure a short term, a long term, we could do a short-term finance. We can do cash. We have every option available to us.
Except for...
No subject to, because there's no debt. But basically, we have every other strategy available to us. So the difference when we're trying to figure out how to make multiple offers to a seller that does have some debt, it will really depend on what that debt is. And so what I want to do is kind of look at a couple of examples. We'll go back to the same example that we've been using, but now we're going to add in a debt payment and look at, you know, wait, first, which one of the strategies will it eliminate? And the ones that it doesn't eliminate, how would we then try to create multiple offers from this? Okay. So let's take first example. Let's say that there is $110,000 owed, and let's say $871 principal and interest payment. Okay. So what option immediately is out?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
The $110,000 balance, $871 a month principal and interest payment.
So probably seller subordination is.
Yeah, it's going to push us, right? Now think about this. Just so that this will probably be the only time that we'll talk about subordination in this particular episode. but it's close enough that we might be able to stretch and still make it work. And if we do, we eliminate that $871 payment. So that's something that you need to take into account, right? That, you know, how much can you eliminate by paying it off? Because we have to pay it off.
Yep.
So we'd have to bring, let's say, $125,000. And what do you think you could borrow that at? And you know, what does that still leave you at 6%? We would get,
saying
625, right? So we're actually saving money based on, you know, where they're at right now. So maybe that would still work. But let's say that in a separate example, let's say that they owe 170, you know, with, you know, $1,100 a month payment. Okay, now it probably doesn't make sense. It's too much. We're not going to go borrow all that money. So, okay. So that's first thing, is that subordination may get eliminated depending on what the debt is. So that would be one less strategy that you would be able to offer. Let's think about our short-term finance strategy. So if it was a rehab or a BRRRR strategy kind of deal, that would these still, couldn't these still work? Would that strategy still work with these examples? Well, if we were, let's say, offering let's say 305 for the property. So for short term, for either of these examples, $110,000 owed, $170,000 owed, we can just agree to either make that payment, or you know, we can offer a different payment that gives them cash flow. But what I would probably do is structure it as $30,000 down, so about 10%, because in this case, I don't really care what my down payment is. It's short term, and I'm either buying it me, or I'm going to wholesale it to a rehabber, and they always have 10% down plus renovation costs, right?
Right.
I mean, even their hard money lender may require that from them.
Yeah.
So I'm probably going to just offer them 30,000, maybe 31, 32, 35, somewhere in there. And most likely on both of these, I would just offer to make the payment for the next 6 to 12 months, whatever term that we agree to. So yes, we have debt. Now, what if the payment was 495? Rather than say, hey, I'll make your monthly payment, they may say, well, I want some cash flow. So I'll pay you $1,200, $1,500 a month, principal only. And I'm happy to do that. Yes, there's more money out of pocket, either to me or my buyer, but it's money and we're going to quickly get right back. So this is for a turnaround where you're literally every month that you're paying it, it's going toward principal, paying it down.
Yeah. So this is more for a, you know, 6 month, 12 month strategy.
Yep.
Six to 12 months.
Yeah. So these types of deals, as long as, you know, they owe less than where your offer is going to come in at, still can be presented, right? That if you can make a cash offer, you can make a short-term finance offer. So if they have enough equity, you can do both.
Right.
But one of the other ways that I would look at, let's say that they owed 270 on this property, and the most that you could really pay is 305. So I could do that in a number of ways. One is I could just pay them all of their equity up front as far as a down payment. Yeah, I could do it as subject to. uh-huh. I'm planning on keeping the property, or I could do it as a wraparound or an all-inclusive. Either way, or I could break it up. Now, maybe they owe $250 on that debt, and I'm going to give them $25 now, and I'll give them the balance of their equity in 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, whatever the term's going to be.
Right.
Okay. So what I'm saying is that particular strategy of the short-term finance, when you're looking to wholesale or retail or wholesale to a rehabber, as long as you can make a cash offer, you still have the option to make this short-term finance offer.
Right.
That's kind of why we tell people to start here, right? Because it's probably the easiest type of financing offer to make.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So now let's look at if we were going to go back to our first two options, which are, like a 3-year, 5-year, 3-year, 6-year, 5-year, 10-year, something, more longer term. Well, first thing is we have to determine what is our potential exit strategy, okay? It is not to sell to a rehabber. It is to do one of two things almost all the time. Landlord.
Yep, or hold it yourself.
Right, or we're going to stay in it and be a part of it. But
yeah,
it's still one of these two buyers is going to be my buyer, right? Or an owner occupant.
Yep.
Okay. So every single time. So let's say this. What if the payment, what if they owed $200,000 and their payment is $1,200 PI, principal and interest? $200,000 is owed and they have a $1,200 a month principal and interest. Okay. We've already determined through previous episodes, the most that we would pay is $1,600 a month in monthly payments, right? Because beyond that there's no, we probably lose out on our owner occupant within reason there. So it's not a landlord property, right? There's no cash flow. But if this property rented for, let's say, $1,600, there's not much we can offer the seller, if any, and still keep that cash flow intact to our buyer or ourselves.
Yeah.
So immediately I would say, all right, this isn't a very good cash flowing property. So I'm going to look at it as an owner occupant, which means that, hey, I can play close to retail and, the better the house is, the better location, the better condition, the more I can pay close to retail. And, as long as the terms are reasonable, that I can make some money on this. So in this case, I might just say, hey, I'll give you, $358, and I'll still pay you the $17,000 down. And instead of $1,200, which is your payment, I'll give you $15. And if taxes and insurance are part of your monthly or part of your escrow in that $1,200, every month we will reimburse you for that. So you'll really get, $1,700 a month. So you'll make a $500 a month cash flow now. But now we're strictly looking at going to an owner occupant, right? So we still need to get that down payment, but we got to get in light.
Yeah.
That's where our payday is coming from. We just got to keep our, if we got that 2.5%, that's a big incentive for our buyers, right? Because they can't get anything like that, even if they went down to the bank and got a loan. So they can't beat that. they're probably willing to pay a little more based on just that particular part of this deal. But 3 years is on the low end for a lot of these types of buyers. But if we set it up this way, we probably can go make ourselves $18,000, wholesaling it to an owner occupant, still giving the seller some cash flow, and in it and out of it, but we're not going to stay in it.
Right.
Okay. So if we go back to one of our first examples, let's say the payment's 871. Now with that, there's probably enough equity to play around with, you know, do we want to potentially sell it to a landlord? And if we did, we got to keep this payment kind of low. Got to figure out, hey, if, you know, let's say 1600 was the max, right? So, you know, we've got to pass on 350 of cash flow to our buyer. And then whatever's left over can go to the seller. So, if the principal and interest is, 871, and we could go up to, you know, 1600 may include taxes and insurance. You will have to, you know, figure that out. But let's say taxes and insurance are another $200. That puts us at 1071 PITI. Now all of a sudden, maybe there's not enough room, because we'd be at about 1420 once we take out $350 cash flow that we're trying to give to the buyer. That leaves about $150 more. You could make that offer, right? Yeah. And see what the seller thinks about it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you up the down payment because landlords typically will pay more down payment than owner occupants. But it's tight. It's tight for, you know, to me, 350, 300 is probably the minimum cash flow that I would say a landlord would accept. So 350s, I mean, it's all right. It's just not great. And if I'm going to, I've got to keep that down payment fairly low if the cash flow is going to be pretty low, because I want that cash on cash return.
Yeah.
To be at least 12%.
Yeah. And here lies the challenge with wraparound mortgages and trying to pay the seller a little piece and, you know, still keep some on the bone, for a landlord, if you, you know, especially if you're wholesaling to a landlord or holding it yourself. Right. Yeah. And there's little cash flow left after, you know, you make the payment to the first mortgage and then the seller. So that's the biggest challenge with wraparound mortgages or all inclusive trust deeds is just making that cash flow work. And, but you know, in a lot of scenarios, they can work, especially, if you're selling to an owner occupant and, you know, you don't need that cash flow there necessarily. And you know, you can still arbitrage your down payment with what you can receive from that owner occupant.
I'll tell you that there's basically two things that you really need to happen to make these deals work when you're not selling to an owner occupant. So, and not everyone's business will include selling to owner occupants, right?
Right.
It's a little different. You know, if I'm a wholesaler, you know, I got a list of buyers. If I'm selling to owner occupants, I may have a list of buyers, but hey, every month, some of those buyers are gone, right? They've rented a place or they, you know, they moved on to something else. They're not my buyers 3 months from now, most likely. So that it's a little different group. But yeah, really what the goal here is that if I can get my seller to wait on some of his or her equity, So, you know, let's say that they owe $200,000. You know, we're buying this property for $358,000. You know, they're owed $158,000 in equity. But if I can get them just to wait on their equity, then where I don't have to make much, if any, of a cash flow payment to them, then I could structure it, right? I have enough room most likely to structure some cash flow. If the seller's not willing to do that, which, you know, you only find this out one of two ways. One, you ask them up front, like, you know, I don't know if there'd be any cash flow. Is that something that's going to work for you if you just, you park your money here for a little while and then you get it, you know, 3 years down the road? Is that something that would work for you? Or I just make the offer and we see where it takes us, right? So can always do that.
Yeah.
But we're going to need the seller's help in that case, right? Yeah. So that's really the key. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself, depending on what's owed, right? The higher the monthly payment, you know, when you start getting, let's say that we feel like our maximum is that $1,600 mark. When you start getting, you know, what's owed an underlying payment of 12, 11, 37, you know, 12, 45, it's starting to create issues. It's like their payment is not going to allow for that cash flow. And immediately, if I want to pursue this, then it becomes an owner-occupant deal.
Yeah. And I, you know, just a thing that comes to mind for me is these deals work more for people who might have a little more equity. Maybe the market's not so hot. Maybe it's a little harder to sell properties. So they're willing to wait on their equity. Maybe they're fixed on their sales price or their asking price. And so, you know, if you can offer them a down payment and then they wait on their equity for a little bit and it doesn't hurt them, this works for those kind of people.
Yeah. Or just someone that needs to be done with this fast and they don't need this money right now. So,
right. Yeah. They got equity, but they just need, you know, they don't want to go to the traditional route. Or they can't, maybe they're under a time crunch. And so they just need to get it done fast and they can wait on that money. Yep. Later on. Okay.
So that becomes the challenge. But to me, the vast majority, you're going to be dealing with landlords or you buying it and staying in the middle and owner occupants. And the way that you figure out where to go with these is there a potential for enough cash flow in it to offer it to a landlord? And if there's not, or maybe there is, but very little money to offer the seller, then you have a choice. And the choice is, do I put together these offers, offering the seller little to no money cash flow wise, and see what the seller says? Or do I just say, hey, I don't think this is going to work. I'm going to make offers based on I'm going to sell to an owner occupant. If there's not usually enough money to sell to a landlord, there's probably not tremendous upside for you to stay in the middle. I wouldn't say that 100% of the time, but more than likely, it's probably not going to play out for you that way. If there wasn't enough money to wholesale it to a landlord, then not sure why you want to stay in the middle. There better be a lot of equity in it. But there is a way to still deal with these and deal with them pretty easily if you're willing to now sell to owner occupants.
Yeah, owner occupants. Or another kind of another strategy, if you find a property like this where you could use it as Airbnb. Yep. Yeah, so that you can, you know, increase that monthly cash flow. That's another scenario where these will work, you know, especially if the cash flow is real tight. So that's something to keep in
mind. If you had a real idea of what you could make, you could probably structure it better to the seller, right? So you don't necessarily need the seller to sit on their equity for the next 3 or 5 years, but maybe you want 6 months of no payment, you know, no cash flow. And then 6 months from now, it'll start kicking in, and you could structure it as, hey, I'm going to have a first mortgage, which is, you know, I'm going to do a wrap around the underlying debt. So, and it's going to be an exact wrap. So whatever the terms are on the underlying debt, that's what I agree to. It's almost like buying it subject to. And then we're going to create a second note or deed of trust for the equity the seller is owed. So all we're doing is breaking up the amount that's owed in the seller's equity, right?
Yep.
And now I'm creating whatever terms I want just on the seller's equity. So could be principal only, or it could start in 6 months when I'm going to start realizing a much larger cash flow than right now. So I could defer it. I could do principal only. I could do like a blended rate, right? Start super low or no interest. And, you know, as we go, that the seller gets more interest or a higher payment. Can do all kinds of things, but and I like the flexibility of that type of structure where the seller's got a bunch of equity. I'm going to divide it into two and try to deal with them each separately.
Yeah. Really create the terms around their equity is what you're saying.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Well, let's wrap it up here then, Jeff. This series have been long enough for our listeners out there. So let's not make it any longer.
All right.
No. Guys, I hope you've really got a wraparound mortgages. It's kind of a more complex strategy. And really the key point, one of the biggest key points is being able to keep your payment where it works for you, and you're able to give some to your seller and still make whatever debt, you know, is on the property, make that debt service. So everything is going to vary depending on the property, the situation, the debt, right? There's no one size fits all here, but what Jeff said here at the end, you know, if you can break, you know, the equity out and the debt owed and make those two separate components and then really create the terms on the equity, that's where you can really get creative. And these deals tend to work more when you can bring in an owner occupant to pass these terms onto, or you can create kind of more cash flow, you know, by doing an Airbnb, renting rooms out individually, you know, whatever you can do to create more cash flow monthly to make those payments work. But, you know, if they have a high payment to begin with and they want more money, monthly, you know, that's where it's conflicting and it doesn't really work is, you got to be able to make that monthly payment work for you or work for your buyer, your owner occupant, whoever that may be.
Yeah, Jonathan, I just thought of something as you were just speaking. And so let's say that you were doing that. You broke it into two mortgages or two trust deeds and notes. And so you have the first. And let's say that first mortgage has been around for 12 years. And so you're getting good principal pay down from that, right? Then you might be getting $500-$600 a month in principal pay down. And because you're further along into the note. Now let's say that you're going to Airbnb it. Instead of getting, you know, the $1,600, you're going to be getting $3,000 a month, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe now what you do is, hey, you're getting some good principal pay down. And maybe the way that you entice your seller is that, hey, I'll pay you 4 or 5% interest on your equity on that same On that note, you know, that we created, you know, that's the seller's equity, interest only. And now we're still keeping our payment fairly low. We're getting some of the principal pay down through that first mortgage. And now maybe we could even extend that note for a longer period of time because the seller's making a good rate of return on their money. And now they're getting that cash flow. Now they feel like their money is really working for them.
Yeah. So that would still keep your payment a little lower because you're not offering any principal pay down on the seller's equity. Right. You get your principal pay down from the first mortgage from the note on that property. Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. So you can definitely, so if they're willing to wait and they're in a position to wait, really they make more money that way because they're just getting interest the longer. Yep. You know, interest, they're making interest on their equity.
Yeah. It's like them making you a loan, right? I mean, a private money loan. I'd be like exactly what we talked about last episode, where we got to go raise money for subordination, except that it's the seller making the loan basically on their own property.
Yeah. Yep. Cool. Well, I like that, Jeff. Have you made any offers like that? Like principal?
No, because I'm not a big Airbnb person. Airbnb worries me. I know people that make a ton of money cash flow wise, which would really entice me. But my concern is that, for the last year, we've been dealing with a pandemic that really affected Airbnbs, right? Just because mm-hmm. travel and tourism and everything. And second, I know that certain cities have restrictions and more cities will have restrictions on who can do Airbnb and what those rules will be. And to me, it's like, what do you do if you get shut down and you no longer can use it as an Airbnb?
Yeah, you have to rent it out long term.
Yeah, and I'm great with that if it works long term, and then you like, hey, I'm gonna Airbnb it. And you know, if I got shut down or I'm like, hey, this is kind of a management nightmare, I'm gonna go back to long term rentals, and you make the kind of return that you're good with, then I'm fine with it. But I don't like buying stuff strictly based on I'm going to Airbnb it, because I think those numbers are somewhat skewed. And right. To me, that's a risk. A risk that doesn't necessarily need to be taken.
The thing that I've always worried about is, you know, if you rely on all of your traffic, you know, all of your short-term rentals from a single site like Airbnb, you know, if they were to ever shut their doors or go out of business, or they stopped doing that, or say they hiked their prices up there and they want 50% of, you know, whatever you're making, they could do that, right? They own the traffic. They own the site where, you know, where all your short-term leases are coming from, so to speak. Yep. So that's the one thing that's always worried about me. If you got one place where all your, you know, short-term tenants are coming from, they own the traffic and they could shut you down anytime they wanted. You can get a bad review on a property and they could be like, well, we're pulling that from our site. Right. So right. There's a ton of risk in it.
One of the things I heard, I'm pretty sure it's true. I'm not positive of the numbers, but I heard San Diego, that they passed legislation about Airbnb that they were only issued like 6,000, 6,500 or so permits that allow you to Airbnb. There are 19,000 properties that are currently used as Airbnb. So yeah. There's 13,000 people or, you know, landlords, owners, right, that had some kind of plan that now that plan is, at least on the surface, is going to change. You know, San Diego, you know, my family rents a house on the beach in, you know, San Diego, Encinitas, Laguna Beach area. And it is not unusual for us to pay like 10 grand for the week. And yeah, you know, so that is big money in Airbnb type properties. But if 13,000 people now have to go figure out a new solution, that's a problem.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I mean, especially here in Salt Lake City, when housing becomes less affordable and you have all these short-term rentals, I mean, in Salt Lake City, they're not even allowed. Airbnbs aren't allowed. But these...
And there's certain... Every city's got a different requirement, right?
Yeah, so. Every city's different, but yeah. And, you know, the more Airbnbs you have out there, the less rental property, long-term rental properties you have on the market, right?
Right. Because yep.
You know, now people convert their long-term into a short-term to make more money, but now there becomes, you know, a shortage of housing, which there is here in Salt Lake City.
Yep. And in many places right now.
Especially hot cities that are growing fast, you know, with good micro economies.
Yep.
Yeah. Good point. Good point.
I know lots of people that do really well with them, but, I'm not positive of how permanent that particular strategy is going to be.
You should always just try to structure a deal based on using it as a long-term rental if need be.
Safe way to go.
Yeah, that's the safe way. That's being conservative, right?
Yep.
In case the city shuts you down, or you know, you lose all the traffic to your property on their website or something like that. But
yep.
Anyway, what's that?
Plan on the worst situation. That exactly. way you're already prepared for it.
Yep. That's how you be conservative in your underwriting. Yep. Okay, guys. Well, I hope that you've enjoyed this episode and that you have kind of a more of an understanding on how to use wraparound mortgages or all-inclusive trust deeds. I know it's kind of hard sometimes to understand it all, but just think of, you know, we mentioned this on the last episode, just think of creative financing as an elephant and you can only eat it one bite at a time. So, you know, the point is to just master, or the goal should be to master one strategy at a time. And then, you know, as you are utilizing that and have full knowledge of it, you know, try offering another strategy. And some of these strategies may not even work in your business model. So don't feel like you need to understand all the ins and outs in every aspect of this. But just keep in mind, it's something that you can have in your tool belt when you need to use it. All of our episodes are at thecreativefinancingpodcast.com. That's our archive. You can find them there. Please join our Facebook group, the Creative Financing Facebook group, if you have not already. We're continuing to build that community to help one another and be a pillar to learning creative financing. If you guys are interested in Jeff's apprenticeship program, it's a wholesaling-based program nationwide. You can contact Rebecca, send her an email at rebecca. We offer options.com. And then if you haven't got our video, step-by-step video on how to create terms, you know, create these different offers that Jeff put together, definitely get that. That's a no-brainer. And you can get that by texting CFP or Creative Financing to 877-409-8090. And that'll also give you a taste of what the Creative Financing Academy is all about. So if you like that, then you'll definitely like the Academy. Hit us up either on our hotline, or you can DM us on Facebook to get access to that as well. Anything I miss here, Jeff, or any last words?
I would tell you that video will help you understand wraps more as well. And at least half of our episodes have something to do with a wrap. We will continue to do more case studies. So if, you know, for whatever reason you didn't quite grasp, you know, how to structure wraps and when you should and when you shouldn't, or how you should, don't worry. There is a ton of information in our podcast about wraps. I mean, we have probably done 80 episodes of some way or another wraps.
Yep, for sure. Hey guys, till next time, go out there and create some terms.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.